and let's read about Jesus. 2 Corinthians 12 is where we are. Raise your hand if you need a Bible. Yeah, my voice is getting thin. I said after last service I wasn't going to sing. This service, I was, yeah, that was going to happen. Man, thanks for sharing your gifts with us, Aaron. 2 Corinthians 12. I want to do something we don't always do. I want to start off reading our passage. 2 Corinthians 12, we left off at verse 10. So beginning in verse 11, I've become a fool in boasting. Paul says, you've compelled me. You left me no choice. I ought to have been commended by you, for nothing was I behind the most eminent apostles, though I am nothing. Truly the signs of an apostle were accomplished among you with all perseverance and signs and wonders and mighty deeds. For what is it in which you were inferior to other churches, except I myself was not burdensome to you? Forgive me. A little sarcastic there. Now for the third time, verse 14, I'm ready to come to you. And I will not be burdensome to you this time either, for I do not seek yours, but you. If you're someone who likes to identify a key verse out of every passage, that's it. I do not seek yours, but you. For the children ought not to lay up for the parents, but the parents for the children. And I will very gladly spend and be spent for your souls. Though lately it seems the more abundantly I love you, the less I'm loved. But be that as it may, I did not burden you, and I will not. If you want to think that being crafty, I caught you by cunning, well, okay, fine. But honestly, did I take advantage of you by any of those whom I sent to you? I urged Titus and sent our brother with him. Did Titus take advantage of you? Did we not walk in the same spirit, walk in the same steps? Again, do you think that we excuse ourselves to you? Am I sounding defensive? We speak before God in Christ. But we do all things, beloved, for you, for your edification. And I fear lest when I come, I shall not find you such as I wish, and that I shall be found by you as you do not wish. I'm afraid we're going to have some intense fellowship. I'm afraid I'm going to find contentions, jealousies, wrath, selfish ambitions, backbiting, whisperings, conceits, tumults. When I come again, my God will humble me among you, and I shall mourn. I'm afraid I'm going to come there and mourn for many who have sinned before and have not repented of uncleanness, fornication, lewdness, which they have practiced. This will be the third time I'm coming to you. By the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word shall be established. I hope that's what happens. I've told you before and foretell now as if I were present the second time. And now being absent, I write to those who have sinned before. I've said this all before. I'm saying it all again. If I come again, I will not spare. Since you seek a proof of Christ speaking in me, who's not weak toward you, but mighty in you. For though he was crucified in weakness, yet he lives by the power of God. For we also are weak in him, but we shall live with him by the power of God toward you. So examine yourselves. Do it now. Do it today. Do it before I get there. As to whether you are in the faith, test yourselves. Do you not know yourselves that Jesus Christ is in you? Unless maybe he's not. Maybe you're disqualified. But I trust you will know that Jesus is in us. And we are not disqualified. 16 verses. Patrick, are you all right? Do you have a fever? Is that why you kept us out in the hall before second service? Yeah, maybe. COVID is a beast. The next person who tells me it's just a bad cold, I'm gonna give you a big wet kiss. 16 verses, but we kind of have to take them together. As Paul gets to the end of this letter, he's summarizing, he's consolidating, he's pulling together some themes that with which he's been exhorting his friends, the Corinthians. It's times like this that Paul kind of sounds like a lawyer. No doubt his training as a Pharisee, his training in rhetoric and argumentation. He's not a flashy lawyer. He's not one of the guys on TV who has the surprise witness or the surprise piece of evidence that turns the prosecution's case upside down. My dad was a lawyer, and Paul was what my dad would call a bricklayer. Not dramatic, not flashy. Paul's way of building his argument is point by point, brick by brick. Evidence, 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 until he gets to his closing, and there's a wall that makes the prosecution's case impossible to prove. And that's what Paul's been doing in his letter for these last 12 chapters, point by point by point. And now it's like he's coming to his closing argument. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, what did you hear? What does all of this add up to? Answer, one word. What's everything that Paul's been saying in this letter? One word. Love. Exactly right. So let's walk through Paul's summation, his closing argument here. It's powerful, and it's going to be even more powerful, I think, as we unpack it. Apologies. Don't have slides. Hoping to get back to that soon. I know some of you really like the bullet points, the signposts to anchor to. So let me give them to you verbally, really quickly. Got your pen ready. Paul is going to tell us, he just told us, but he's going to tell us his love for the Corinthians is real, and his ministry isn't about him, it's about them. His zeal for others. His concern, he sees that the enemy has come in and is trying to steal the Corinthians away, to make them kneel before a God who's not the true and living God. Trying to make them ignore what they know and prioritize what they feel. And Paul says, look, this might not make me popular, but I'm going to speak the truth in love. That's my deal with God. He saved me through his love. I go and speak of his love. And I'm going to keep doing that. And I'm going to ask you to look at in the mirror. And look in your hearts and see what that reveals, remembering the reason we're here, all of us, to help this world and the broken and lost souls in this world heal. If that was too quick, I'll call them out as we go. Just some signposts to help guide us as we navigate through this passage. Paul starts off verse 11, pointing out, I love you guys, and there's nothing you can do about it. My compassion, my concern for you, it's real, and hopefully by the time you've gotten to this point in the letter, you realize that, you see that. I know false teachers have told you it's not true. They've tried to discredit me. They've tried to convince you I'm not a real apostle. Here's my question, verse 11. By what criteria, in what way, do any of the apostles excel me? Peter, James, John, good guys, and I'm not saying I'm better than them, but they're not more than me. Verse 12, I teach like an apostle, don't I? I do miracles like an apostle. I discipled you. I trained you. So in what respect, verse 13, did I shortchange you? Tell me how I ripped you off. The only thing I can think of, I didn't ask you to support me. When I was with you, other churches met my needs. They supported me financially while I was with you. If you're hurt by that, I'm sorry. Paul being sarcastic. Because we know, he tells us elsewhere, in fact, in this letter, it's a privilege to support those who serve the Lord. We get crowns for supporting those who are sent out. Paul didn't ask the Corinthians to do that, not that they wanted to, but he didn't ask to guard against the accusation that he was in it for the money, that he was a mercenary in some way. He says, I didn't want to give you any reason to think my love for you was less than real. I didn't, and I still don't. Verse 14, I'm getting ready to come to you a third time, so get ready to feel ripped off again. I'm not going to let you support me this time either. I could, it would be fine, legitimate, reasonable, biblical, but I'm not going to do it. Because I want you to be 100% crystal clear in your minds. I'm coming to support you. I'm coming to serve you. I'm coming for the same reason I came the first time and the time after that. I'm writing to you now for the same reason I wrote to you for the first time and the time after that. I love you. And I know that you don't always get that, he says, verse 15. Sometimes, especially lately, it seems like the harder I try to love you, the more you doubt me. The more I love you, the more you question my motives. You scratch your head and wonder about my ministry. And I know this has happened to you. Me talking to you. We've all gone through that, right? The harder we try with someone, the behinder we get. My friend Pachawaris was speaking at the pastor's gathering in Denver I was telling you about. And he told the story. He renamed his church recently. For 25 years, it was Calvary Chapel Montebello, East LA. He pastors in the hood. But he told the story when he went out from Calvary West Covina, where my pastor's from, where Don Duncan is from. When he went out from West Covina to plant the church, the Lord gave him a vision, actually gave his wife, Millie, a vision of an ark, that the church would be an ark, that people would come into it and be saved and be protected, sheltered from the storm. And God led them to a building that looked like a big boat. It looked like an ark. But the powers that be said, no, we don't do tutti-frutti names in Calvary. You're Calvary Chapel Montebello. But 23 years into ministry, coming up on his 25th anniversary, he said, "You know what? We're gonna go back to the name the Lord gave us. 25th anniversary. We're gonna rebrand. We're gonna relaunch, and we're gonna be the Ark." And for 2 years, he warned people that that was gonna happen. For 2 years, he said, "Here's the plan, and it's not about breaking with anyone or distancing from anyone or disavowing anyone. It's 25 years ago, my wife and this vision." And when it happened, from all sides, people wanted to impute all kinds of motives and tell him, "This is what you really did. This is your real intention." He says, "Don't I know my intention?" Paul is saying the same thing. Maybe if I hadn't tried to love you, I wouldn't have given you any reason to doubt. Pontius is like, maybe I should have just quietly rebranded and not made an announcement. It seems like the more I told people what it wasn't, the more they said, "Oh, yeah, it is." Paul's asking the same thing. If I hadn't tried to love you, you'd have no reason to doubt my love. But the thing is, I did love you, and you do doubt me. You do have questions about me. You do question my motives. But verse 16, I need to ask you, you need to tell me, verse 16, what did I do wrong? What should I have done differently? I tricked you? How did I trick you? I brought you the gospel. I brought you to Jesus. End of story. "Oh, but now you think we owe you something." No, I do not. See, Paul went to them in the name of the Lord, in the spirit of the gospel itself. And the thing about the gospel, it's the free gift of salvation, right? The free gift of forgiveness. And that is what people trip over many times. The hardest thing about the gospel for many people is that we don't have to earn it. We don't do anything to deserve it. Jesus paid the price, costs us nothing. That was me, Paul is saying. That was me coming to you, serving in God's name, expecting nothing in return. And verse 17, that was my guys too. Titus, the other guys that I sent, same spirit, same heart, loving you, expecting nothing in return. Now, having gotten this far, Paul kind of pauses and he says, Now, by this point, you got to be wondering why I'm so hyped on this. Why I'm making such a big deal out of this. Because he's making a big deal out of this, yeah? I mean, not just in this section. Really, the whole letter. Paul starts off the letter. He says, "Hi, I'm Paul," and he pops the clutch. He lays a patch. "Yeah, I'm zealous. You're hearing zeal from me, passion. But it's not what you think. My goal in defending my ministry, it's not about me. I'm not worried about my reputation, whether I'm going to get a letter of recommendation, whether you're going to tell other churches, yeah, you got to have Paul speak. He's fantastic. No, it's not about us. It's about you. The things I say and do, Paul says, I do out of my zeal for you, that you would be edified, that you would be grown, built up, matured as Christ followers." And listen, there's a couple points this morning where if you miss something, you're going to miss the whole thing. We're going to turn a corner. I don't want you to go straight. So listen. When false teachers came in, they told lies about Paul. They said, "Paul, you're not an apostle. You're a B-postle at best, maybe a C or a D-postle." I know I've used the joke before, but I really like it. Why does Paul care? Why doesn't he just kick the dust off and say, "I'm going to go spend time with people who like me? I'm going to go spend time with people who appreciate my ministry. I'm going to go hang out in Ephesus. They love me in Ephesus. Answer, what's the answer? Love, yeah. Paul loves them, and he's watching Satan and Satan's workers, verse 20, trying to steal him away from Jesus. Verse 20, Paul says, you remember what you were like when I first met you? You remember the contentions and jealousies and wrath and selfishness and ambition and backbiting, whisperings, conceits and tumults? Summarize all of that in one word for me. Everything what Paul just said, one word. Selfish. Sin also works. But sin comes from selfishness. Sin comes from pride. That's what defined you, he's saying. Me, my, mine. And your reaction when you didn't get what you wanted, what you thought that you needed, what you thought you deserved, well, that's what we see in verse 20. That's what we see in verse 21. Uncleanness and fornication and lewdness. That's who you were. And I'm really afraid that when I come see you, that's what I'm going to see again. I'm concerned about the level of sin and selfishness that's returned to your community. That you've gone back to squabbling and bickering and gossiping and sexual immorality of every kind. Because, and this is me talking to you. Because Paul's implication here, they're all subsets of the same problem. They're all expressions of the same root issue, selfishness. The world revolves around me. If I don't get what I want, I'm going to chase it, verse 20. I'm going to blame someone, tear someone down if I don't get it, also verse 20. Or I'm going to go sin to make myself feel better, verse 21. In my sin and selfishness, I think I know what I deserve, and if I don't get it, and if I feel deprived by not having it, I'm going to go do something about it. I'm going to do something to make myself feel better. Because if God doesn't give me what I need, well, then all of his guidelines go out the window. Those guardrails to keep me safe and sane? No. I'm going to climb over them and I'm going to get mine any way that I can. And that right there explains the pornography epidemic in our country. We are not, contrary to popular belief, the pornography epidemic is not because America is lustful or sex crazed. More than any other people group. No, it's because we're sad. We're depressed. We're anxious. We're living lives that are not satisfying, not fulfilling, and so we're medicating ourselves to make ourselves feel better, if only for a little while. And it's incredibly addictive because it's free. We carry it with us. It's one click away. It's easily accessible. And it never quite delivers on the promise that it makes. But next time, that's a recipe for addiction. Pornography says, God's ripping you off. I'll stand in the gap. I'll make you feel better the way that God isn't. It's happening to the church in the 21st century. Paul's point, he thinks it's happening to his church in the first century. Same thing, Satan coming in, sending people in to steal people away. I said that there were a couple points that you needed to stay with me. Here's another one. Don't get up on two wheels, stay with me. The Corinthians were led away from God the same way that we are. We are born selfish. That's the human condition. If you don't believe that, I have a 2-year-old friend that I want you to meet. We're born looking out for number one with a sin nature, getting ours, survival of the fittest, kill or be killed, do unto others, but do it first. What is the only thing that changes that? Jesus. Jesus is the only thing, the only one who interrupts that cycle. Paul's saying, look, that I came to you to do that. I brought you to the gospel of Jesus Christ like a midwife to deliver you from that, to deliver you from sin and selfishness to Jesus. I did it because I loved you. I did it because Jesus loved me and changed me and came to live in me, and that love gave me a love for you. That love compelled me to go to you. That love drove me to speak the truth to you. That love wouldn't let me leave you in darkness. That's the whole story of the love that I tried to pass on to you. And so here's the big idea. That's why the enemies of the gospel have singled me out, Paul says. Because I was who brought Jesus to you. I brought the gospel to you. I introduced you to Jesus. And I taught you the outworking of the gospel. The manifestation of Jesus in you. The only reasonable response to what Jesus has done for you is love. This is Romans 12:1. He just hasn't written it yet. Having responded to the gospel, a gospel of love, having been saved by love, our only reasonable response is to go out and love. John 15:12, Jesus says, hey, you saw how I loved you? Go love people that way. What you saw me do, do that. That's why I came to you, Paul says. That's why I've done everything. That's why I've said everything that I've said to you. But what if it's a lie? This is the reason for the attack that Paul has endured. This is the reason for the attack that the church endures. What if it's a lie? What if it's not why I came, Paul says? What if I did have an ulterior motive? Well, then everything falls apart. Go forth and love each other, Jesus says. But Paul is admitting, the only way you know that is through me. What if I'm lying? What if Jesus never said that? What if that's not why I came? Well, then you have no reason to believe the gospel. That's what the false teachers are doing. They're trying to steal them away. If they can discredit Paul, they discredit the gospel. They're trying to steal you away. Paul says, I'm trying to stop the steal. They're trying to steal the truth, the grace, the love that is in your hearts. I don't know if they can steal your salvation, but I know what they will do. I know what they want to do. I know what they're trying to do. They're trying to steal your love, keep it from going out into the world, keep you from showing people Jesus. They're trying to steal the life that Jesus purchased for you, the life that isn't supposed to be about you anymore, but about God and others and loving others to God. See, take that away. If they can pull that brick out, like the Jenga game we saw the teens playing in the video, pull that brick out, the whole tower collapses. If they can discredit Paul, they discredit the gospel. They discredit the gospel, they discredit Jesus. They discredit Jesus, well, then the only God that we kneel to is we ourselves. We're left worshiping the trinity of stupidity, me, myself, and I. My wishes, my wants, my desires. And this isn't a theoretical concern. Paul's not talking about this because it's an intellectual possibility. It's reality. Paul has seen it, just like you and I have seen it. Looking at that youth retreat video again, debriefing the retreat with Juan, I said, man, it's got to be challenging. I know it's challenging standing up teaching a mixed multitude. You got believers and unbelievers. You got young adults who are on fire for the Lord. And you got some who are hearing the gospel for the very first time. And Juan pointed out correctly, the really difficult category is the third category. Not the believers, not the unbelievers, but the make-believers. The ones who are saying, yeah, I'm about Jesus, but their lives say otherwise. Here's a phrase for you. Functional atheism. The Jesus that they say they believe in doesn't have an impact on anything else they believe, doesn't change their worldview, doesn't change their conduct. They're still living for themselves. And here's the thing, it's not just youth. Functional atheism. Adults can drift into it. People serving in ministry can drift into it. People leading, pastoring can fall into it. How does it happen? Paul's point, we're still hanging out between the chapters here. The reason we go back and kneel to our own gods, there's a part of us that wants to. Even redeemed, we still have a sin nature. So there's this battle. The love that God has placed in us points us to others, but our sin nature still cries out, what about me? Serve me. Love me. And that part in all of us wants to believe that Paul and people like Paul are phonies and frauds and scam artists. Because if it's true, then we've got permission to ignore them. If they're liars, well, then I can give myself permission to blow Jesus off. Because if they're liars, then the gospel probably isn't real and church is a scam and I can live for myself. That's the big idea here. When I see a Christian behaving badly, especially someone of stature, someone of standing, but even if not, if someone in the church lets me down, my flesh says, see, it's all a lie. It's all a shakedown. Stop following Jesus. The way to make sure your needs are met is to go meet your needs. Our sin nature wants to. That's the big idea, not a new idea. Not a new idea. You've seen this. You've seen this in many conversations I know that you've had with unbelievers. You talk to someone who hasn't made up their mind about Jesus, how does the conversation start? Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. Cool. What aren't you sure of? I don't know. Great. What don't you know? What don't you know that you want to know? I don't know. Well, I mean, it makes sense that you'd have questions. What are your questions? Well, I just had bad experiences with church people. Man, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry that happened to you. But the thing is, that's people. What do you think about the Bible? What do you think about Jesus? Because people disappoint. Jesus never does. Well, I'm not sure I believe that. What's getting in the way of you believing that? Can I tell you why I believe it? Can I talk to you about some evidence? Because maybe then you'll have questions and I can try to answer them. Well, no, I don't want to. Why? Why does the conversation so often end there? Because it does, right? You've had that experience. At least part of the answer is that if they listen, they might change their minds. And if they change their minds, they might have to change their lives. And my life won't be about me anymore. God, others, no thank you. You've had that conversation with unbelievers, but what about in church? Satan tries to do the same thing in this building, in this family. I was really offended by what that person said. I don't agree with the way that person's doing this. I don't think I like the direction this is headed. I hate that all of the walls are brown. Me too, we're working on it. but do you see it's the same thing? Satan's not original. He hasn't had an original thought in all of recorded history. It's a variation of the very first thing we see him do in the garden. His very first strategy. Has God really said? He got Eve asking that question. And Paul's pointing out he's trying to get the Corinthians by asking that question. He wants to get us asking that question of each other. Is this what a godly person really says? Is this what a godly person would really do? Is this how a man or woman of God should act? Well, no. Well, then, maybe I won't act like a godly person either. If that's how church people are, maybe I don't need church. Maybe I don't need Jesus. Maybe I should just go back to what I'm doing because church people let me down. Church people disappoint me. That's how Satan kneecapped Eve, right? Has God really said? And again, she was predisposed to listen. Why? Her flesh. Satan got her focused on herself. He said, God's holding out on you. Things could be better for you. Don't you feel like something's missing? Don't you feel like maybe your needs aren't being met? Once she bit on that question, there's no way she wasn't going to bite the apple or the pear or the pomegranate or whatever it was. Satan said, hey, look around, the place you're in, the people that you're with, are they satisfying you? Are they serving you, completing you, fulfilling you? And it's a trick question because the answer is always no. He asks it like that's possible. It isn't. This world can't satisfy. It's broken. The people in the world can't complete us. They're broken too. Even in Christ, we're busticated. That's why we need Jesus. Only he can satisfy. But see, if Satan can get us looking at the world or the people in the world or the church or the people in the church, we're going to be disappointed. And if we're disappointed, enough for long enough, we're going to ask ourselves, what's the point? And we're going to make it about ourselves. And we're going to go back to taking care of me, what I want, how I feel. In verses 20 and 21, when I don't get what I want, if I say this is what I feel like and it's out of reach, I'm going to go do something about it. Or I'm going to go get something to make myself feel better. What's the answer? Hasn't changed since the last time I asked. It's Jesus. The answer to the problem Paul is describing is we need to get our eyes off of people and keep our eyes off of people. We need to follow Jesus, love like Jesus, because he gives us purpose and he gives us power and he gives us peace. Are you tracking? Am I explaining this okay? Because the brain fog is real. And I'm going to use that excuse for a few weeks at least. False teachers got Corinth looking at Paul. He's a bad guy. And you know, once someone says, hey, look out for so-and-so, they're a bad guy. You find evidence to support that, don't you? You've probably experienced it. You've probably been on the other end of it. You did something innocent with the best of intentions, with Christ in your heart, but someone said, yeah, but they're a really bad guy. And people look right past it. If you have kids, I guarantee you've lived that. You love them with all of your heart and soul and mind and strength, and they turned around and said, yeah, I hate you. The false teachers did that. They're serving Satan. Satan is what? He's an accuser. He makes sure the things we do with the best of intentions are seen in the worst possible light. And the Corinthians bought it because their sin nature wanted to. If Paul's selfish in serving himself, then I've got permission to be selfish and serving myself. What's Paul's answer? This is where we cross over to chapter 13 and we sprint for the finish line. Paul's answer, he says, hey, y'all need to make up your own minds. You need to make up your mind about the Bible. You need to make up your mind about Jesus. Most of all, you need to make up your mind about yourself. It's not about me. You need to make up your mind about you. Who are you going to serve? Verse 1, Paul says, hey, I'm going to keep loving you because I know who I'm going to serve. I'm going to keep coming back to you. In verse 2, when I get to you, I'm going to say the same thing that I've said before. Verse 3, I'm going to say it for the same reason. God and I have a deal. He saved me. He loved me, so I go and love people in his name. Not for money or popularity. I do it because the love of Christ compels me. I've decided to follow Jesus. No turning back. The cross before me, the world behind me. No turning back. Third verse is the one that lands it. Though none go with me, still I will follow. Though some reject me, still I will follow. Though people disappoint me, still I will follow. And if you think about it, the Corinthians could have been Paul's excuse for quitting if his eyes were on them. Paul could have said, yo, I spoke the truth in love. I did everything God told me to do. You're still a bunch of carnal knuckleheads, so what's the point? I'm going to go back to making tents. He could have quit, blamed it on them, said, it's the Corinthians' fault. They didn't want to hear the truth, so I'm going to stop trying. I'm going to serve myself. He could have quit and blamed it on the Corinthians if his eyes had been on them. Listen, he could have quit and blamed it on himself if his eyes had been on him. They're not listening. They're not responding, I must not be eloquent enough, attractive enough, trained enough, charismatic enough. I don't know how to reach this new generation. I'm not connected enough. I might as well stop trying. See, but verse 4, he says, the thing is, it's not about you. And it's not about me. It's about Jesus. It's always about Jesus. His love, his power, the calling he placed on my life. And by the way, the calling he placed on yours, same calling, the calling we share to love people in his name. When we take the deal that Jesus offers us at the cross, hey, you give me all your sin, I'll give you all my righteousness. Part of that deal is that he becomes our purpose and our power. And we find in him the peace and the rest and the joy we're looking for. That's why I came. Verse 4, God called me to you. He called me to encourage you in grace, to exhort you in the truth, to remind you of his love, and to tell you it's what we're here to do. That's everything we're here to be. We're here to be grace pushers. We're here to be salvation dealers. Jesus people, we're here to love. And my question, verse 5, my question to you, Paul asks, what's your response? I've written this, I've said it every way that I know how to say it. Now, all that's left is you got to take a look at yourself, examine yourself, do some honest soul searching. What does an unflinching look in the mirror reveal? What's he asking? Are you saved? Do you know you're saved? Can you prove you're saved? And what's the test he's proposing? Do you love like someone who's saved? No, wait, time out. Patrick, I read Romans 10:10. I know Paul hasn't written it yet, but now he has, and I read it, and it says, believe in your heart and confess with your lips that Jesus is Lord. That's salvation. Okay. Good. Cool. No argument. What does it mean to confess with your lips? And don't actions speak louder than words? You say that you're saved. Hey, I've repented of my sin, and I've asked for forgiveness based on the price that Jesus paid. I've asked that the punishment that Jesus bore on the cross extend to the punishment for my sin. That's great. How do you know? How do you know that you know? How would you prove it to someone who's asking? Be ready to give a reason for the hope that's within you. Why would someone wonder about the hope that's within you? Unless they're seeing something in you. How do you prove it to yourself in those moments longer than moments, honestly, right? Those long nights. Sometimes days strung together when we wonder, am I really saved? How do we know? Paul just gave us an answer. Do you love? Because our flesh can't. They'll know we are Christians, John 13:35, by our love. Love is evidence of salvation. They'll know that we're Christians by our love, but here's the thing, so will we. If I can watch myself loving, and if I do an honest soul searching and say, yeah, I'm not trying to give so that I get, I'm giving to give. I'm loving because love loves. That's how I know I'm saved. Peter, 2 Peter 1, my life chapter, he says the same thing. He says, make your call and election sure. Prove that you're saved. How? The answer that he gives, you can track it down, is love. He says, add to your faith virtue, knowledge, self-control, perseverance, brotherly kindness, love. Love, and you'll be fruitful. Love, you'll be a witness. Love, you'll build the kingdom. But if you don't love, people won't see anything in you, and you won't either. If you don't love, you'll start to doubt. If you doubt long enough, you'll start to deny. If you don't see love, you have no reason to believe that God's love has made a difference in you. Stop loving or never start loving. You're going to forget why you're saved, how you're saved. You'll forget that you're saved. Keep loving. and you'll remember why you're saved and how you were saved and the purpose for which you were saved. And you'll never doubt because you'll be seeing the evidence. That's Peter. Back to Paul, verse 5. He says, examine yourself. If you don't like what you see, if you don't like what that soul search reveals, well, then change your soul. Give your life to Jesus. Confess your sin. Repent. Decide to be done. Decide to follow Him. Well, I've already done that. Okay, maybe you need to do it again. Maybe you need to rededicate yourself to Him. Maybe you need to reboot. Ask for a fresh filling of the Spirit. Ask for Jesus to revive you, to fill you, to empower you, to love even when it hurts, even when it's hard, even when no one loves you back, even when nothing seems to change, because love loves. And because when we love, not only will we draw people into the kingdom, when we love, we won't be those people pushing people away from the kingdom. We won't be the excuse for anyone to turn their back on God. How do I do that, Patrick? I don't know. Who are the people in your life? Ask the question, who's in front of me that I can serve? Love people by bringing Jesus into the conversation. Brother was talking to me this week. People at work asked him, how come you don't cuss? He said, because Jesus. It's that easy. There's all kinds of opportunities to just drop breadcrumbs like that. If we're listening, if we're tuning our hearts to love. How do I love? Ask people, how can I pray for you? That works for believers and unbelievers. Love them by praying for them right there. Love them by remembering them. Keep a list. Continue to pray. Follow up. Ask Him how God answered. Love people by getting plugged into some small group, some ministry, some Bible study, some small community where you can have visibility of people's needs, practical and spiritual, and you can be committed to meeting those needs, loving them. The church can be a clearinghouse for that if you don't have that community yet. If you say, hey, I've got ABC skills and XYZ availability, we'll gladly be a hub and connect you with needs in the family, needs in the community. Love people by getting plugged into ministry here or elsewhere. Love people by coming to church with the intention of giving, of serving, of blessing. Who can I smile at? Who can I talk to? Who can I meet? Who can I introduce myself to? Who can I invite for coffee or lunch? The through line is you love by deciding to. You love by deciding wherever you go, whoever you're with, you're going to serve. You're going to lighten loads, brighten days, make things better. How can I show others that Jesus is a real person who loves them? The very best way, the way that God has ordained, is to put in front of them a Jesus person who's really loving them, who really cares about them, who believes that Jesus wants to heal them of sin and shame and doubt and depression and helplessness and hopelessness, and love is how He does it. You don't have to look hard to find an excuse not to. If you've been here any length of time, there's an excuse in this room. Someone in this room, probably me, has disappointed you. Me, someone in leadership, maybe just someone sitting in the seats wasn't there for you. Didn't love you the way that you needed to be loved. If you've been here any length of time, that's happened to you. If you're new here, maybe you're here because that happened in the church that you came from. It happened somewhere else. Okay, let me save you the surprise. It's going to happen here too. Spoiler alert. When it does, do what Paul is doing. Go to the person. Do what Scripture tells us. Hey, when you did this or when you didn't do this, it hurt, and this is how and this is why. And that person might learn something, or you might learn something. You might learn that what you experienced is what they what what they intended? Three sides to every story, my side, your side, and what really happened. But you know, the thing is, sooner or later, we're going to hurt each other. We're human. We're still in process. We see imperfectly. We follow through inconsistently. We battle our sin nature. And that's not an excuse. That's part of the reason for church. Church is designed to be a place where we fail each other and forgive each other. This is the place where we're reminded that we need grace and we're challenged to give grace. So let me wrap this up with an appeal. That wasn't on the list I gave you. This is a bonus one. When it's your turn, ask for grace. When it's your turn, offer grace. When it's your turn to turn away because of what somebody did, turn toward them instead. Love each other. Because look at how Paul ends. Verse 6, he says, you know I'm not disqualified. You know I'm a believer. You know I'm a Christ follower. I'm not saying I do it perfectly. I'm not saying I always get it right. But you know the pattern of my life is I'm setting aside everything to love you. That's Paul's heart and Christ's heart and God's hope for us. That would be the pattern of our lives, that would be the testimony. That as we love, we would draw people in. And that as we love, we would avoid being the people that give people an excuse to turn away. Aaron, come on back up, brother. Can we just decide that? Choose that.